Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 48.
Ordifay 8A. That's big Latin.
Back in Brooklyn, after our whirlwind week tour of the United States of San Diego, Las Vegas, Chicago, and Brooklyn.
We really just bopped across the country.
We really did. We kicked it off with a wedding,
though. My cousin's wedding. Another MAGA girl off the market.
Yeah, number 5 of 6 weddings we're going to this year.
Yeah. Although this one was like the best. It was a rabbi, but he was like a real stoner rabbi who looked like Marc Maron. So it's like Marc Maron times rabbi. And it was like the best combination.
Yeah, it looked like a sketch that Marc Maron was doing.
I really thought, I was like, this isn't real. It was like an SNL sketch or something.
But it was really good. Congratulations to Laura and Hale. Yes. After the wedding, we went back down to San Diego to meet up with two of our close friends and the super talented choreographer dancers, Keone and Marty Madrid.
Funny story about their last name, though. When we first met them, for some reason, Josh called them Madrid. And I was like practicing saying their name. I was like, Keone, and then we have Keone and Mari Madrid. And they're like, Lindsay, it's just Madrid.
Listen, it could be worse. They've told us stories where people introduce them as Keone and Mary.
Keone and Mary. Right, at least we got their name, their first name's right. This was like, what, 4 years ago?
Probably more than 4 years ago at this point. But we are working on a brand new show with them that's going to open next year. We can't tell you guys too much about it, A, because we're not allowed to, and B, because we don't know too much about it. We're really in the part where we're writing the show, hiring the team, bringing on the designers. What I can tell you is it's going to be a dance show, predominantly dance. It's going to be in the style of Keone Mara's choreography, and it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, I think it's going to be super cool and something that we've never done before. And something that they've never done before and a really cool step in their careers, I think.
When I started out doing producing and directing, one of my big inspirations was Danny Boyle, who's a film director. He did Slumdog Millionaire. He's done a lot of things. But what I really liked about him is that every single movie he's done is in a completely different genre. Like one's a zombie movie, one's a space movie, one's Slumdog Millionaire. He did Trainspotting, which maybe is his best known one after Slumdog.
Didn't he also direct some theater?
He's directed one of my favorite theater pieces, Frankenstein, where the two lead actors switch off being on and off. I bring this up because I do sort of want to emulate in my own work that every project really has a distinct feel and not like we just do this one category of thing. So we have Slumber, which is sort of this murder circus pop dance show. We have Misbehave, which is a two-person adult game show, now this new dance show with Keone and Mari, and a few other things that I don't know if we're... Am I allowed to tease them? Maybe not on this episode. You gotta stay tuned.
No, let's wait.
We can only do one upcoming project per episode.
Yeah, but it'll be sweet. But if you want to hear any more details as we figure them out, make sure to subscribe on our mailing list. Emailing list. I wish we still did mailing lists, like... You know,
do you? I have to stamp every single card you send out.
Yeah, but I love that. Like, I love addressing envelopes. I'm doing my thank you notes for our wedding and I'm loving it. Subscribe to our email list, which is on our website at hideawaycircus.com to find the latest news about
our shows.
Our upcoming projects.
So after San Diego, we rented a car from Avis and drove from San Diego all the way to Las Vegas, stopping in Barstow. On the way. Barstow is like a little town between L.A. and Vegas that, like, serves people driving from L.A. to Vegas.
Yeah. Did our it's like a pop-up in the middle of the desert of every food chain you could imagine.
But it's strange. You're, like, driving for, like, the whole drive is about 4.5 hours and nothing.
Barstow,
like, food court in the mall. nothing.
Las Vegas! No, there's something that you get to first that looks... And I was, like, not paying attention. I was like, whoa, is this Las Vegas? It looks so much smaller than I remember. Remember that town?
Oh,
that
yeah, that's just on the right in the border of Nevada and California.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but...
There's
a roller coaster. That wasn't working.
Anyways, we made it to Las Vegas in about 4.5 hours. Why were we in Vegas? Why did we go to Vegas, Linz?
Well, some of you know we are associate producing a show called Misbehave Game Show at Bally's Casino and Resort on the Strip in Las Vegas, which is a two-person adult game show where Amy Saunders, or Misbehave, she splits the audience into people with iPhones and people with not iPhones. and makes them compete against each other. And it's
gotten... She doesn't make anybody do anything. That's the thing. You can sit there do nothing and watch the entire show.
That's true. You could do nothing or you could do everything. And the rules are there are no rules. And it's gotten massive critical acclaim and the audience is loving it. We read some Yelp reviews, which I didn't know was a thing, but we read them and they're amazing.
But it's like 125 Yelp reviews. The show's been open for like 2 months and we have 4.5 stars. So, you know, the people like it.
People like it. Some exciting developments with that show, which is why we were there, is some new producers have been brought on whose specialty is Vegas. Because right now the show is really amazing, but no one knows about it. So the new plan is we close the show for 2 weeks so we can rebrand and fix some of the theater problems, which didn't have the time to do it when the show was opening. So we're relaunching the show
October 11th
with some new marketing, which you should definitely follow the show's Instagram, which is run by Misbehave. It's called her handle is still Miss M-I-S Behaven, no G. So still Miss Behaven, and definitely follow Brett's character.
Tiffany. And her handle is Tiffany M-B-G-S.
And you can see like kind of their backstage stories of this show. And
they've been doing
really
some vlogging, which is really, really funny. But they're like mini 30-second vlogs.
Yeah, because we all told them to do vlogs or do stories. And now they're like, fine, we'll do them. And they're really funny. So definitely follow that. But that was like a fun trip. And while we were there, we saw Ka.
Man, I've been dying for Lindsay to see Ka since we met. Ka is one of my all-time favorite Cirque du Soleil shows. I first saw it when one of my best friends, Spencer Novick, was in it. But it's Cirque's most expensive show. On the poster, it says it cost them $170 million. But my inside sources tell me it costs close to $250 million when you account for also the building of the theater. And the show itself is an epic journey about two twins who get separated and have to reunite. And what makes it special is that there is sort of no stage and the world's craziest stage simultaneously. Mm-hmm. If you would imagine going into a Broadway theater, a traditional proscenium, the last row of seats, then the stage starts. In Ka's case, last row of seats, like a barrier, and then a 50, 60-foot drop. And, you know, hundreds of feet up, as you would have sort of like the fly space in a regular theater. And the stage itself comes out of the wall and can turn 360 degrees. There's projection mapping. There's, like, large effects with sand. It's actually cork, but it looks like sand, and some crazy high-flying aerial scenes. So, Lindsay, as somebody who's seen it for the first time, what'd you think?
Well, I thought it was amazing. Definitely some scenes that I didn't like, but for the most part, there were some scenes that were just so breathtakingly beautiful, and also, like, man, like, the things you can do when you have time and money is insane. Like, there's this whole chase along this, well, it looks like an ice wall, but it's, you know, the stage, and it's turned vertical up and down, and you're climbing, and these people are climbing with pegs, and it looks like arrow. I mean, I can't even explain it because it's so crazy, but it was so beautiful. I think it was the only Cirque show that I've seen that I could follow like an actual story. I wouldn't say I like totally cared about them, but I definitely followed the story and cared enough to like be like, oh, I hope they get back together.
Yes, I think the show is also very cinematic. Like, between the sound of it, you're so far away from the action that it's almost like looking at a frame, the way you are looking at a frame when you're watching a TV or a movie screen. I'm with you on the story being super clear. I think when people say, can you do storytelling in circus, the answer is yes, and people have been doing it probably for hundreds of years. But this is just another really good example of story incorporated in circus with multiple characters, B storylines, and really crazy acts.
Although the character that Spencer, when he was in the show, played has like this crazy like long hair on half of his head, and I couldn't picture anything except Spencer doing that part. And so he's supposed to be like evil and causing like all these problems. I couldn't stop watching him because I was like, I can't believe Spencer did that. Like, Spencer wouldn't jump off the water like from 4 feet, yet he was hanging in the air at like 100 feet every night. So what up with that, Spencer?
What up?
It was a really good show. I'm really glad I saw it. It's an amazing theater.
Speaking of shows that we saw on our trip after Las Vegas, we headed all the way over to Chicago to see Midnight Circus.
We did. Another classically great circus.
Midnight Circus is run by Jeff and Julie Jenkins. We've talked about it on the podcast a few times before. But we were there because we wanted to see our friends, support the new show. It was at a new site this year, Lake Shore Park, which is actually quite cool. It was right in the downtown, surrounded by skyscrapers.
The acts are really great this year. There was a lot of acts this year, more than ever. But that just shows how many people like want to work with Midnight. But Ezra Wheel did a hat juggling act that was really great. I'd only seen him do his rope act at his ENC graduation, and so seeing the hat act was really good. Adam Kukler, another like solid, amazing performer.
Always good.
Always can pull the audience. Like, he does cigar box juggling, and it's so good. And he has the audience in the palm of his hand, cheering and like on his side, and it's a real skill. And if anyone out there is listening who wants to be a clown,
Find some Adam Kukler videos
and watch what he does and learn from him, because he is just incredible. It was great to finally see Tula Moon's act, because we had not had the chance to see her when we were in Adelaide because she got injured and when she was doing Filament. But she was in Midnight and did her hoop act, her aerial hoop act, and you know, she's again just really, really good. It was really hot in the tent. Like, it was like a 90 degree day, which was really weird. But, you know, everyone like gave it their best, and it was great to watch.
So before we get into the interview, there's, as we typically talk about, some news stories. There's one that popped up maybe a week or two ago in Broadway World, which is not your typical place to find a circus story. But it was titled The Rise and Fall of Cirque du Soleil on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And it was this long expose written by the editor about Cirque theatricals and sort of the journey that Cirque has been on in New York, which we've talked about ad nauseum on this show, and what's happened recently. And the new news from it is that it seems like Cirque has closed its doors on its Cirque theatrical division.
Yeah, I mean, one interesting thing is Scott Zager was in charge of the theatrical arm of Cirque, and he was an odd choice because his experience was really in Las Vegas working with Bass, who did a lot of the Broadway show versions in Vegas. And he's an alumni of Clear Channel Entertainment, which again is like a massive corporation. And it's interesting that Cirque didn't pick someone who actually worked in theater
in New York.
And, you know, Paramore didn't do very well. The Wiz couldn't get a theater because no one wanted it, except one theater that could only offer a year, which obviously, if you know anything about simple math, Cirque show costs a lot, and in 1 year, you cannot make that back. So, I'm not surprised, but oh well, goodbye Cirque du Soleil theatricals.
See you probably next year when you guys try again.
Yeah. So this week on our podcast, we had
Christine Van Loo, who is a U.S. national champion in acrobatic gymnastics. She was the female Olympian athlete of the year. She has run multiple different circus schools. One she's running right now is called Airborne Arts. It's in Costa Rica. She is a motivational speaker and an overall super interesting woman. I wanted to talk to Christine originally because a lot of the people we talk to who are circus performers have that traditional going to circus school method or going through being multiple generations. And Christine's a good example of somebody who came to it through sport. She's a really good example of other things you can do within the circus world concurrently with performing or after performing.
What's interesting with her, and what also like mirrored our conversation with Olga Karmansky, who was also a guest, is that in both, you know, Olympic gymnasts, they both weren't the best when they started, but they really worked hard and they were the most driven. And I think that's a really good lesson to take from both of their podcasts, is like, you don't have to be the best at something, but you have to be the most willing to put the time and effort in and practice.
Grit.
That's
what it takes. Grit. Any case, before we let you listen to our interview with Christine,
if you like our podcast, make sure to like us on Facebook, subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, follow us on Instagram, and follow us on Twitter, so you can Twitter tweet us, or you can email us at hello@hadawaycircus.com.
Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, email, website. Do all of them.
Do all of them. No, just kidding. Just do what you want, which is all of them.
All right, here's our interview. Christine, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are you in Costa Rica at the moment?
I am. I'm at home right now. Yep.
Oh, nice. How's the weather down there? Probably like sunshine and warm and lovely.
It is. It's pretty much the 70s to 80s, at least where I live, all year long. So we're in rainy season, but it's still beautiful most of the day. Then it rains a bit at night. And to be honest with you, rainy season is the most beautiful season because it's so lush and the waterfalls are really big and popping and it's just beautiful.
Oh, wow.
Do you live there year round then?
I do. Yeah. I travel a lot within the year to perform, but, I do live here year round. Yeah.
Are you originally from Costa Rica or are you from somewhere else?
No, I'm American. I grew up in America. I've also lived in Italy and Mexico and now Costa Rica, but I lived in America for most of my life.
Where in the States did you grow up?
The place I grew up, which I moved to when I was 5, was New Orleans. And I was there through college. But the last place that I lived for a long time was Santa Monica in California.
Oh. And how did you get into gymnastics as a kid?
I was hyperactive and driving my friends crazy. So when I was 8, my dad saw an exhibition on TV I was in a sport called acrobatic gymnastics, which is a partnering gymnastics sport. And my dad saw an exhibition on television by a Russian coach and his partner. And he brought me to the gym and I tried out and I just fell in love with it.
What was so appealing about it the first time you went?
I always wanted to fly. Like I spent most of my childhood jumping up from tables and porches and chairs, flapping my arms like wings. And the first time I walked into the gym and I saw kids flying through the air, I was like, oh my God, this is for me. And I also loved the fact that acrogymnastics is as much artistic as it is athletic. And I'm kind of half and half of that. I really love artistic, creative things. So I felt like I was expressing myself while also getting a lot of my energy out and, you know, challenging myself.
Acrobatic gymnastics isn't, you know, as common in the U.S. as it is, you know, in Europe and particularly in Eastern Europe. Was it easy to sort of progress through that sport here, or was it a bit of a challenge?
It was hard for me because I was not I was not athletically inclined as a kid. I was actually the worst kid and the worst athlete in my class for a long time, last person to learn all the tricks and move up in levels. So it was very challenging for me. Yeah. But I kept with it and eventually I got better at it. But no, there were some good acrobats. There are actually some world champion acrobats that are U.S. citizens now. Americans now. So we've got good acrobats now.
Would you mind explaining? Cause I looked at pictures of what you did and I was like, that is amazing. Can you explain to listeners just kind of what acro gymnastics, kind of Absolutely. Is and entails?
Absolutely. Well, there are 3 gymnastic sports. There's artistic gymnastics, which is what most people think of when you think of gymnastics, which has the stationary apparatus like the bars, the beam, the vault, and the floor exercise. Then there's rhythmic gymnastics, which is movable apparatus such as the balls, the ribbons, the hoops, the clubs. And then there's acrobatic gymnastics, or it used to be called sports acrobatics too, same thing. And there's no apparatus whatsoever. We have a gymnastics floor exercise mat, and 2 or more people work together in pairs or groups doing balance movements on each other and tempo, which are flight elements and tosses and catches and dismounts and tumbling and dance and so forth. And there are 5 events there are pair groups. There's men's pairs, women's trios, men's fours, and mixed pairs, which what I was, boy, girl. And we also have platform tumbling. So
I'm just like, you're a hand-to-hand dream.
Sorry again?
You're a hand-to-hand couple's dream. How did you end up finding your partner? Did you stay with the same partner your whole training, or did you switch through different people?
I had 3 different partners growing up. The first one from age 8 to 12, the second one from age 12 to 14, and then the third one from 14 until I retired at 19.
Were the dudes your age or were they older?
They were older.
I was imagining a little 8-year-old boy throwing this little girl.
Yeah, they're all about 4, 5, 6 years older than me.
Oh, wow.
And you took it pretty far. You were a 7-time national champion and member of the U.S. ACCO gymnastics team. What was that like when you were sort of at the peak of that sport? Were you traveling a lot? What was the lifestyle?
I was traveling a lot, yeah. I was still going to school full-time and just always going up to my teachers being like, I'm sorry, I got to go again. Can you give me some homework? And then I would go to, you know, out of state for nationals, out of the country for world championships or World Cup. And then every year Japan would send us, I got flown to Japan every year by the owner of Fujifilm and the Japanese Gymnastics Federation to do exhibitions and competitions. And they made creational instructional books and videos of my partner and I. So yeah, I was traveling a lot. It was just tough school. I mean, I did well in school. I was valedictorian in my high school, but I always felt totally stressed out that I was going to fail school.
We on a previous podcast, we interviewed Olga Karmansky, who was a U.S. champion rhythmic gymnast. And one of the things that she mentioned on her episode was that the judging in these kinds of sports are super political, and that, you know, often the Russians, the Chinese, or really anybody, I guess, often votes for their own team, and that it ends up being not just about your skill level, but also about sort of this political balance as you climb up the athletic ladder. Was that the case for you as well?
Yeah, I did notice that a bit. I mean, I tried to stay out of the political idea of it for me, because for me, it wasn't not, I mean, I did well in competition, but it wasn't always about winning. It was just about excelling and doing better, you know, improving myself. But you're right. I remember being at, where was it? In China for World Cup 1 year. And the men's fours, their balance routine just consists of one skill, because it takes them like quite a while to climb up four guys standing on top of each other's shoulders with the top guy doing like high handstands and stuff on the guy's head and so forth. And then once they're into that final balancing position, they're supposed to ring a bell four times, like dong, 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 for four seconds. And every country that went up, Russians, Bulgarians, Americans, the bell was like dong, dong.
Like super slow.
But when the Chinese got up, it was like dong, 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 dong.
Did you compete, or were you like a performer at the Olympics?
Yeah, well, yes and no. My sport is considered an Olympic sport, but it's not competitive yet. So I did not compete at the Olympics. But I was chosen Olympic Female Athlete of the Year because it is considered an Olympic sport. Our federation gets to choose the best male and female athletes from that sport. And I was sent to Portland, Oregon to do this really grand ceremony with all these other Olympic athletes like Carl Lewis and Jackie Joyner Kersee and Matt Biondi and so forth. So yes, and that, but I did actually perform at the Olympics aerially.
That must have been quite a crazy moment, being sort of the end of your teenage years and being recognized as such a predominant athlete. How did you feel? Were you sort of like, oh man, what's next? Were you lost? Were you feeling like you'd accomplished everything you wanted to accomplish? What was your like mental state at that point?
Oh goodness, great question. Well, while I was competing, it just seemed like a lot of cool things were flowing in, and I kind of just took it one step at a time and was pretty excited and grateful for everything that came. And then when I was 19, my acrobatic partner quit. And suddenly I wasn't an acrobat anymore. And that was pretty traumatic for me, because I had always identified myself as an acrogymnast. And suddenly I found myself in a sophomore in college, and I had never dated, you know, the only thing I knew was acrogymnastics, and I didn't have that anymore. And that was kind of a feeling of, what do I do next? And that was, so I spent a few years kind of feeling lost a bit. So, do you want me to continue on from there?
Yeah, please. Tell us about how that sort of transition happened. I mean, I think many people can relate to that feeling of sort of coming out of your teenage years, particularly if you're an athlete, and sort of having to go through that transition.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I spent 5 years teaching. I finished college and I spent 5 years teaching. And during that time, I actually married my first boyfriend, which I don't really recommend. I mean, he's a great guy, but it's kind of hindsight is 2020.
Right.
And we moved to Italy, and then we moved to Orlando. And I became a Navy officer's wife during that time, which was really crazy for me because I didn't identify myself as that either. So while we were living in Florida at the end of that relationship, I was teaching, and one of the things, and I taught everything. I taught aerobics, dance, gymnastics, acrobatics, you know, everything. And one day, a friend of mine from New Orleans, where I grew up, told me, "I'm coming to Orlando to audition for Cirque du Soleil at Brown's Gymnastics." And I said, "Oh, I teach at Brown's Gymnastics. I'm going to go watch you and, you know, be your cheerleader and support you." So I went to watch the audition and to support my friend. And I sat down in the bleachers, and I looked over at all these athletes on the floor stretching, and my hands started shaking. And I was like, I couldn't stop them from shaking. So I gripped the bleachers, and then my whole body started rocking back and forth. And then it was like, suddenly I realized that I was looking at my life from the outside. And I was like, oh my God, like, these are my people. This is my family. And I stood up and I walked over to the audition list and I wrote my name down on the list. And I did this 7-hour audition, and I had the best time I'd had in years, like since I'd retired from competition. And although I had done really well in competition, I didn't think I would be selected because I didn't have a partner to show what I could do. However, that same week, the casting director called me and she said, "I want to offer you a 2-year contract with a show called Kidam." And she said I would be in an act called Corps d'Elise, which I had no idea what that was. It's aerial rowback. I didn't know what that word was. And at first I was like, oh my God, this is like my dream coming true. And then my husband at the time walked in the doorway and I was like, oh my God, I can't take this job. I can't just leave for 2 years. So I turned it down. And that was the decision I had to make at the time, because that was what was right at the time. But it was really hard to make. And I remember kind of feeling like I was on automatic pilot after that. But eventually I found another show where I could go do shows, like corporate shows, and then come back home. And eventually that show went off. I ended that relationship and I went on tour with that company for 10 months. And I ended up becoming an aerialist at the end of that journey. So.
Wow, that must have been such an emotional moment. One of the reasons that I was really excited to talk to you is, you know, we try to do this podcast so that people who are interested in circus and coming up through it hear the stories of people who've had different careers and different experiences. And one of the things that really struck me looking through sort of your history is just the amount of special events that you've done and the sort of the variety of things, as opposed to touring for Cirque du Soleil for 10 years and that sort of being your career. Can you talk a little bit about sort of those next steps and how you ended up booking these special events that took you around the world?
Absolutely. Well, first it took learning the aerial act, which when I was in that show, I started that show just as a background cast member. I wasn't an aerialist or an acrobat or anything. Like, I was just choreographing for the show and doing dancing. And one day they asked me if I would be willing to learn 3 basic aerial tricks for an upcoming show that they had. They wanted to choreograph me in. And I was like, hell yeah. I started driving every Thursday 4 hours from Orlando to Miami, where I trained in a 110-degree warehouse with an old acrobatic teammate of mine who had quit Cirque du Soleil. And it was on the Corps d'Elise, the rope, the aerial rope. And I remember when I first started, I couldn't wait to start. I was so excited. And by the end of the first class, literally my hands, this is what happened. Managed to climb all the way to the top of the rope. And I was so tired and exhausted that I slid down the rope like a fireman's pole.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh. And I lifted my hands, and my hands, like, I had literally torn all of the skin off my palms and fingers.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, my God, there goes the end of my aerial career.
Well, that's also like when you know you're a real circus performer as well.
Exactly. And then my friend said, up again. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, look at my hands. And he's like, I'm sorry. It's the only way to build up enough strength. So I bandaged my hands in toilet paper and duct tape, and I kept climbing. And I remember that evening, like, going into my hotel room and just, like, laying there with, like, so defeated, completely defeated, and thinking I was going to quit, because there's just no way. I couldn't take the pain. I couldn't take the disappointment. But finally being like, screw this, I'm doing this, you know? And then I just kept driving to Miami. I had no idea how I was going to do this, but I kept driving to Miami every Thursday and climbing and climbing and climbing and climbing until it started getting easier. And I eventually went on tour with that company, like I said, for 10 months. And I still wasn't really an aerialist. I had in my pocket maybe 3 or 4 tricks. But I moved to LA after that, and I totally do not recommend this to any of your listeners, but at the time there were not really any instructors out there. So I ended up teaching myself aerial.
And oh my God.
Yeah. It was really, really, really hard. And I don't recommend it to anybody. I just didn't have, I didn't have a choice, you know? And like, I was so much in my own guinea pig that, you know, it's called aerial silks. Mm-hmm. Well, I bought silk fabric, which is not the fabric you're supposed to buy. I didn't know any better. And I literally set myself on fire doing a slack job once because it was the wrong fabric.
Oh my God. That's when you know, like, circus performers are just so crazy. Because mm-hmm. Josh made me do a swinging trapeze class. So he was like, you need to learn what it feels like. And my hands were so sore. I did it once for like an hour. And I was like, well, did not miss my calling as a circus performer. Because you have to just be like so down to be in pain most of your time.
Exactly. You're right. That's like, you have to be in for discomfort and just be willing to go through that discomfort, whatever, however severe it may be.
Yeah. Wow. So when you moved to LA, were you still married to your first husband?
No, that marriage ended on the tour that I went on. Like, we knew we didn't belong together. We just didn't want to hurt each other. So it kind of stretched out for a long, long time.
Right. You moved out to LA just because you wanted to,
I mean, I didn't know where else to go. And honestly, just a friend of mine on the tour said, you should move to LA. So I was like, okay, I'll do that. And I really liked LA, so I stayed there for a long time. So while I was in LA, like I said, I taught myself to do aerial, and I put together a coeur-de-lis act. And now I look back at it, and it was really bad, but at the time, it was all I had. And I had a savings from that tour, and it wasn't very big, but it was enough to like keep me alive for a little while. And then I started like teaching again aerobics and gymnastics, and eventually, I mean, I realized that I only had enough energy to train or to be teaching all day. And I was like, I have to make a choice. Like, I have to choose my dream, or I have to just become an aerobics teacher. And this is the choice. And I was like, I really want to be an aerialist, but I never had an aerial job, you know, I'd just been this dancer in this show. So what I did was I took out of my savings, which was probably $8,000. I took $6,000 of it. And I spent it on a promo video, like the best damn promo video that I could make. And I spent all my days, I quit my jobs teaching aerobics. I had like $2,000 more to live off from. And I spent my days promoting myself. And I sent that video out, it was a VHS. I sent it out to like probably 200 entertainment agencies. And I got one call back. And I was so excited about that call back. And they hired me to do a single corporate show in Las Vegas. And I went there and I was just like super professional about it. I gave them my all. And then they recommended me to another show, and they recommended me to another show. And that became the beginning of my career. And I've worked ever since then. So, yeah.
Good and promo video.
Yeah, that investment was clearly worth it.
Totally worth it. And when I say I've worked ever since then, I mean, I've done everything from like the cheesiest birthday party to like the Olympics, you know, and touring with Paul McCartney and stuff. So, and I've taken everything in between, and I've loved every single moment of it.
One of the things that I saw on your sort of like list of amazing different credits and productions is that you worked with NBC's Celebrity Circus, which was I don't know how many seasons it was, but it was one of the very few reality television shows that sort of tried to tackle, could you do what American Idol and So You Think You Can Dance and sort of all these performance shows, can you sort of adapt that to circus? Can you sort of just tell us a little bit about what that experience was like trying to create circus for television very specifically, which, you know, one doesn't really see that often.
It was fun, especially at the beginning, got more challenging as we went on. It was fun, but definitely challenging because you're trying to make people who have no circus background look very professional, you know, and it's tricky to do that, to find those skills that you know are flashy and beautiful, but are not going to kill your student. But yeah, it was fun. It was all day, every day for like 3 months. It was only one season. Yeah, I don't know.
Who was even on that?
I think one of the Jackass guys was on that.
Wee
Man. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He was great. I loved him. He was awesome.
Yeah, he's awesome. No, yeah, we love those whole guys have weird circus connections. Like, I think Steve-O went to Ringling Clown College. Oh, cool. Yeah, I was so curious. I'd seen that one season. And I was like, oh, amazing. Somebody I get to talk to worked on that production. I just wanted to know a little bit about it.
The guys especially had a really good attitude about their job. You know, they'd come in like super motivated and gung-ho and wanted to try everything. And yeah.
Sort of another category of show, special event that I've seen you've done a lot is concerts for Britney Spears and Paul McCartney. Can you sort of talk about what it's like to be on that kind of show where you're performing in front of these sort of large arenas full of people and the focus is essentially the superstar, but they're hiring dancers and aerialists and acrobats to create the show around them?
Sure. I didn't tour with Britney Spears, but I did choreograph the aerial portion of her tour, her world tour. Not the last world tour, the one before that. So, but Paul McCartney I did tour with, and I have to say that was probably one of my favorite shows ever. First of all, Paul McCartney is an amazing man. He's just the kindest, gentlest soul. And his show is super professional and lovely. And we got to tour all over Europe and perform in front of hundreds of thousands of people at a time and in these magnificent venues. And can I tell you my favorite story about that?
Please.
About Paul McCartney? Okay, so we were one of the places that we toured was St. Petersburg, Russia. And I don't know if you know anything about the Beatles and Russia, but the Beatles were banned from they never had been in Russia because they were banned because of it being communist. And it cost a half a month salary to buy a Beatles album. And if you were caught with it, you were thrown in prison. Like, that's how banned they were. Now, so how do I go from here? So anyhow, I arrived at the venue earlier in the day and they had evacuated, the Russian military had evacuated St. Petersburg a mile in every direction. And we had performed in the center of the Hermitage Theater. So there were like tanks and helicopters and snipers on the roofs and all these Russian military army guys everywhere. And then I brought out my camera to take a picture and somebody grabbed my camera from me to stop me, and it was just like, it looked like a war zone. And then as the concert time came in, they started letting the people in, and 100,000 people flooded in. Like, I had never seen that many people in one place at the same time. And I did a solo on the stage, and I remember I couldn't even see the end of the people. And after I was done, I went in front of the barricade to watch the show, and I remember looking back out at the crowd, and 100,000 Russian people were singing and all of them had tears running down their faces. And it was just like this beautiful moment in history. And I was so lucky to be a part of it. And at the very end of the evening, oh, I forgot to tell you one other thing. Right before the show, it started raining. So they sent a missile a jet into the space to stop the rain. They stopped the rain twice.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyhow, at the end of the night, we were driving back in our tour bus to the hotel, and it was a white night, which means the sun never goes down. And we started driving around a roundabout, and there was this Russian statue in the middle. And behind it, there was a moving billboard of Paul McCartney singing. And across it all, there was a rainbow stretched across the sky at 1 a.m. And I was like, that's just the perfect ending to this perfect historic day. So
wow, that's
I feel
so
really
fun
for that experience.
So what year was that then?
2004.
Oh, cool.
That's pretty recent for the first performance of anybody from the Beatles. So tell us a little bit about what sort of your transition to being a motivational speaker and your school in Costa Rica.
Okay. So my husband, Jonathan Conant, he was co-founder of Chappie School New York. I don't know if you've heard of it, but
sure.
It's a Chappie School. Yeah.
And it's not just in New York, right? They have one in Boston. They have a few locations.
Yeah, they have them in Boston, Chicago, L.A., D.C., New York. And anyhow, he sold that company to his business partners. And in the non-compete, of course, you're not supposed to open up another trapeze school in the same country. But that's his passion. So we thought, well, where else could you be happy? And we both have been to Costa Rica together and apart many times, and we loved it here. So, well, we actually even looked into property in different countries. We made a bid on a property in South Africa. We had tickets to go to Ecuador. We were looking in Italy. But Costa Rica ended up being the winner. Like, we really love it here. So we moved here, and we started Airborne Arts, which is an aerial retreat center overlooking a 600-foot waterfall and the ocean in this valley of mountains. And we've got a flying trapeze and an open aerial deck. And it's just so beautiful. It's really fun to come and take classes or go on retreats or just come and stay with us and go on adventures. So that's that part. And then as a motivational speaker, so I kind of feel like my purpose and mission in life is to inspire people. That's when I feel happiest. And whether that is through teaching or performing or speaking, I always feel happiest doing that. So the speaking part came when I was still living in Los Angeles and my car broke down and I went to go get it fixed. And I had to sit there for like 3 or 4 hours. And I was sitting with this guy named Christopher Kai, and he was asking me questions about my profession. And I was telling him, and he asked me if I would be willing to speak to some homeless kids at the Mission in LA. It's called Mondays at the Mission. And apparently every Monday he has somebody from whatever walk of life. He's had Elon Musk go to speak to the homeless kids and directors and actors and producers and so forth. And I felt really honored to be asked. So I went and I told them, you know, my story, and I taught them a class and I did a little show for them. And I left feeling so buzzed and up that I was like, this is really what I want to do. Like, I want to be inspiring people through my word. So through my stories. So that's my next venture right now that I'm working on is speaking. And I'm giving speeches wherever, whoever will listen to me.
So tell me a little bit about how you tie in sort of what it's, you know, your career as an acrobat and circus performer and teacher, but how does that sort of apply to, you know, an average Joe's life?
Oh yeah. Well, my speech, my current speech that I've been giving recently is called How to Create a Larger Vision of Yourself. And it's about undefining your sense of identity, because we all have this really strong idea of who we are, which limits the things that we're capable of doing. Because if we're like, well, this is who I am, but I'm not that, then we can't do that or incorporate that into our lives. And that's kind of what I went through when I told you, you know, when I left that marriage, that first marriage that I, with my boyfriend, I was like, okay, I've been a Navy officer's wife, and I've been his girlfriend, and I've been this, and I've been that, I'm a fitness instructor. But no, suddenly those things kind of fell off of me. And now I'm like, oh my God, if I'm not those things, what am I? And it was quite an empowering place to come from, to realize I don't have to be those things. I can be whatever I choose to be. And that this is a lesson that goes for anybody on the planet, not just an aerialist, you know. What do we want in our lives, and how can we become that by enlarging our sense of identity and our sense of self? And these are kind of lessons on how to learn that.
Nice. I want to hear that talk.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's interesting that you sort of talk about that, because I think that sort of theme applies in so many different places, and not even just in one's own career, but even in one's like own artistic style. Like, oh, I can't do a contemporary styled act because everything I do is traditional, or vice versa. Like, it plays on many, many levels.
Absolutely. We get so stuck in who we think we are that we don't evolve to that next level.
So maybe I am a circus artist.
Yeah, maybe you got to get through the pain, Lindsay.
I just have to get through the pain.
Well, I remember that I told you when I the morning that my ex and I decided not to be together anymore, instead of feeling like depressed about it, I remember walking. I was in Washington, D.C. at the time. I remember walking down the streets of Washington, D.C. thinking, oh, my God, like, I can move to Kenya and open a chimpanzee refuge, or I can, like, join a Harley Davidson biker gang, or I can like go to India and join an ashram. Like, the whole world is open to me now, because I don't identify myself with any one thing. Like, I don't live anywhere. I don't have a job after this. Like, I'm not whatever. I'm totally open in this big, I'm a big open canvas that I can paint any color on. And that was really exciting.
So for somebody who's sort of listening to the podcast and is inspired by your career and looks up your motivational talks on YouTube and is sort of thinking like, how do I take the next steps to become a circus performer and book these more unusual kinds of things, say like maybe going on tour, like you said, for 2 years isn't really an option to me. Is there any advice that you would give basically yourself, the earlier version of yourself?
Yeah, well, there's lots of different options. I would probably just tell myself, because I think when I started that initial company that I was working with and I was a cast member for, I worked for them for quite a long time, but I didn't even know that other companies really existed. And so I was really scared of leaving that company, even though I wasn't an aerialist working with them. And I wanted to be an aerialist. And finally, I had to be like, just do the plunge and stop working with them. And then trust that there was going to be other work in the world for me. And once I did that, it was like all these other companies started picking me up. And I was like, oh my God, well, there's corporate shows and there's private parties and there's tours of this and there's like carnivals of that. And there's cruise ships and there's, you know, music concerts. And there's like a million places that want entertainment. And it was just that fear of, oh my gosh, if I stop working with this one company, I'm not going to have anything, you know, and that's just not true. And I would have liked to have known that a bit earlier.
Well, we always wrap up the podcast with three questions. Ooh. So the first question is,
has there been a piece of advice, good or bad, that somebody has given you that's stuck with you?
Yes. And this is actually in my speech. And it was my mother's roommate, actually, who gave this to me. She said, and this applies to anything and everything, from buying a t-shirt to a Tesla, to getting into a relationship, to what you eat, to whatever choice it is that you're about to make, little or small. And this is that you should always ask this one little question that makes a huge impact first. Ask yourself, is this a hell yes? And if it's not a hell yes, and you choose to wear it, eat it, date it, buy it, do it for a living, marry it, waste 1 second of your precious life on it, then you are simply adding clutter and mediocrity to your life. But worst of all, you're telling yourself that you don't matter. So no matter what choice you're about to make, ask yourself, is this a hell yes?
Well, hell yes to that answer.
Yeah, have you heard of that book that's like, what's it called? Oh, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up.
No.
It's this book. It's amazing. And it's basically like the same kind of thought of, does this give you joy? Does this spark joy in your life? And if it doesn't, get rid of it.
Like, yeah, exactly.
I went on a rampage in our apartment of throwing away so many things because I was like, this isn't bringing me joy.
That's how I met my husband. Like, I had gone through all these crazy relationships and then finally, I came to this place, like making all these excuses for people that I didn't belong with, just being like, is this a hell yes or not? You know? And then I met my husband and yes, he is a hell yes.
So. Yeah, that's a great thing for relationships. Is it a hell yes?
Yeah.
So the second question is there something that you've seen or read that you feel like was really inspiring and people who want to be in this business should see or read?
Well, I mean, I know this is probably not answering your question, but I've been listening to a lot of YouTube videos lately by motivational speakers and like people like Les Brown and Tony Robbins and so forth. And they always inspire me. Everything they say, like sometimes I don't feel like training or working. I wake up and I don't feel like working toward my goals. And so I'll put those guys on and I'm like, yeah, I'm into it now. I'm going for my dreams. So I guess I just listen to like podcasts. I do read a lot of books and stuff too, but I can't say that it was anything directed that would be inspirational for circus performers.
No, that's sorry. Good.
That's great. Everybody should be listening to Tony Robbins when they need a little bit of like extra oomph.
Yeah, exactly.
So the final question is, who do you think we should have on the podcast next?
Oh, you should probably have my husband on the podcast. I don't know if he would feel like it or not, but I could ask him. His name's Jonathan Conant, and he was, like I said, he was the co-founder of Trapeze School New York. I'd have to ask him. Who else? Oh, you know who else you could have? Natalie Gauthier. She runs an amazing children's performance group in Los Angeles called Le Petit Cirque, I believe their names are now. And they're incredible. They're traveling all over the world performing, and they've got, I think, anyhow, you'd love them.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Well, those are both great choices. Your husband in particular, I'm very curious to hear what the story behind TSNY is, as it's, you know, such a prolific teaching institution now in the States.
He has an amazing story, so yeah.
So we'll convince him.
Awesome. Well, Christine, thank you so much for talking to Lindsay and I. It was a pleasure having you on the podcast.
It's been a total pleasure for me. Thank you so much for having me.
And that was our interview with Christine Van Loo.
If you like that podcast, make sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com, subscribe on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, and subscribe at hideawaycircus.com.
And if you're going to Vegas, get your tickets to Misbehave Game Show.
Yes.
Is that enough plugs?
I don't know.
Do you guys want more plugs?
More hair plugs? That was a bad joke.
See you next week.